The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. The podcast versions of the original Facebook Live readings during the coronavirus outbreak by Matthew Ogden, the Bearded Wit. Please bear in mind that as Facebook Live recordings, these are rough and ready. There are mistakes, there are a few trip-ups here and there, and there is laughter from the reader as he goes through and follows the humour himself along with you, the listener. We hope you enjoy listening to these and share liberally. Part 32. Before we begin, I'd like to ask you to seriously consider becoming a patron of The Bearded Wit by going to patreon.com/thebeardedwit. You can support me from as little as $5 a month, which is essentially a cup of coffee, and that will mean that I will be able to continue producing this material and other podcasts that I do, and it would mean the world to me to have you know that you've got my back on this. I love producing this material for people, and it's been a huge pleasure for me to do this, which basically started as a project for family and friends right back at the beginning of March last year, when the COVID-19 virus was really beginning to kick in. It was a way of basically connecting friends and family all over the world who were finding it a bit difficult, as we all did. And it's grown into something where I've got a lot of people listening all over the world. It would mean the world to me if you could take the time just to pop over to patreon.com/thebeardedwit, sign up from as little as $5 a month. As I say, it's a cup of coffee. It would mean the world to me, because the more of you guys, you fabulous people out there that do it, the more I'm able to do more of this stuff for you on an ongoing basis. No obligation, but if you can, I would be so deeply grateful. Also, if you could take a moment to pop over to Facebook and give The Bearded Wit a like and follow, and also go over to my new YouTube channel as well, just search for The Bearded Wit, and subscribe. I'll be putting all of the live readings, slightly edited and cleaned up a bit, onto that over the coming weeks. But yeah, join up, get involved, like, share, follow, subscribe, do all the usual social media things. Okay, on with the reading. Thanks very much, everyone. So, a recap. Where did we get to? So, as regular listeners will know, we are well into Mostly Harmless, the fifth book penned by the wonderful Douglas Adams, where we have discovered that Arthur has been stranded on the planet Lamuella, where he has become renowned as the sandwich maker. And he was, according to old Thrashbarg, the sandwich maker sent from Bob. And old Thrashbarg has basically had a hard time trying to keep the people of Lamuella docile. He's had to fold in an awful lot of spaceships and crashes into his completely made-up narrative. And then Trillian turned up with someone called Random in tow, and Random turned out to be her teenage daughter, who was also Arthur's daughter, because after the destruction of the Earth in this timeline, in this universe, he was the only other person in the universe with the right DNA. So, as he had used his DNA as a way of, his unique DNA, as a way of getting upgrades in space travel, there was a lot of it for her to use. And the byproduct of all of that was Random. But she's busy working in the space-time continuum news world, which means she can't really have a 13-year-old child in tow with her all the time. So she dumped her on Arthur. They were just beginning to get to know each other when the gift, or the box, not really a gift actually, it's a curse, that Ford had discovered in the building of the guide, which has been taken over, we find out, by Infinidium Enterprises, who are in turn Vogons. They have completely revamped the guide, and the guide is this now one guide that they can basically send through the space-time continuum. That is incredibly vain, hyper-intelligent, and basically is going to screw up everything if we're not careful. And that was sent to La Muela, opened the box by Random. Random got seduced by how groovy this new guide was and disappeared off into the space-time continuum with the guide. But Ford landed on the ship that the guide manipulated to land on the planet. Random hit him because she didn't know who he was. They got into the ship and disappeared. And now Ford and Arthur have been stranded on La Muela. What they have then discovered is that the perfectly normal beast, which appears twice a year in various migrations crossing the Anhondo Plain, is obviously coming through a rift in the space-time continuum. They've decided to ride one of these perfectly normal beasts through the space-time rift to try and get off the planet. That's where we left them. Thrashberg, by the way, loves this because now he gets to be top dog again on planet La Muela. So he had no problem encouraging them to get onto a gigantic bison-like thing and disappearing off into quite potentially nothing. And that's where we are. Let's read on. Misty grey buildings loomed and flickered. They bounced up and down in a highly embarrassing way. What sort of buildings were they? What were they for? What did they remind her of? It's so difficult to know what things are supposed to be when you suddenly turn up unexpectedly on a different world which has a different culture, a different set of the most basic assumptions about life, and also incredibly dull and meaningless architecture. The sky above the buildings was a cold and hostile black. The stars, which should have been blindingly brilliant points of light this far from the sun, were blurred and dulled by the thickness of the huge shielding bubble. Perspex, or something like it. Something dull and heavy, anyway. Tricia wound the tape back again to the beginning. She knew there was something slightly odd about it. Well, in fact, there were about a million things that were slightly odd about it, but there was one that was nagging at her, and she hadn't quite got it. She sighed and yawned. As she waited for the tape to rewind, she cleared away some of the dirty polystyrene coffee cups that had accumulated on the editing desk and tipped them into the bin. She was sitting in a small editing suite at a video production company in Soho. She had Do Not Disturb notices plastered all over the door and a block on all incoming calls at the switchboard. This was originally to protect her astonishing scoop, but now it was to protect her from embarrassment. She would watch the tape all the way through again from the beginning, if she could bear to. She might do some fast-forwarding here and there. It was about 4 o'clock on a Monday afternoon, and she had a kind of sick feeling. She was trying to work out what the cause of this slightly sick feeling was, and there was no shortage of candidates. First of all, it had come on top of the overnight flight from New York, the red eye, always a killer, that. Then, being accosted by aliens on her lawn and flown out to the planet Rupert. She was not sufficiently experienced in that sort of thing to be able to say for sure that was always a killer, but she would be prepared to bet that those who went through it regularly cursed it. There were always stress charts being published in magazines. 50 stress points for losing your job, 75 points for a divorce, or changing your hairstyle, and so on. None of them ever mentioned being accosted on your lawn by aliens and then being flown to the planet Rupert. But she was sure it was worth a few dozen points. It wasn't that the journey had been particularly stressful. It had been extremely dull, in fact. Certainly it had been no more stressful than the trip she'd just taken across the Atlantic, and it had taken roughly the same time, about 7 hours. Well, that was pretty astounding, wasn't it? Flying to the outer limits of the solar system in the same time that it took to fly to New York meant they must have some fantastic, unheard-of form of propulsion in the ship. She quizzed her hosts about it, and they agreed it was pretty good. But how does it work? She had demanded excitedly. She was still quite excited at the beginning of the trip. she found that part of the tape, she found that part of the tape and played it through to herself. The Grebulons, which is what they called themselves, were politely showing her which buttons they pressed to make the ship go. "Yes, but what principle does it work on?" she heard herself demand from behind the camera. "Oh, you mean is it something like a warp drive or something like that?" they said. "Yes," persisted Tricia. "That. What is it?" "It probably is something of the kind," they said. "Like what?" "Warp drive, photon drive, something like that. You'd have to ask the flight engineer." "Which one is he?" "We don't know. We've all lost our minds, you see." "Oh, yes," said Tricia a little faintly. "So you said. How did you lose your minds exactly then?" "We don't know," they said patiently. "Because you've lost your minds," echoed Tricia glumly. "Would you like to watch television? It is a long flight. We watch television. It is something we enjoy." All of this riveting stuff was on the tape, and fine viewing it made. First of all, the picture quality was extremely poor. Tricia didn't know why this was exactly. She had a feeling that the Grebulons responded to a slightly different range of light frequencies, and that there had been a lot of ultraviolet around, which was probably mucking up the video camera. There were a lot of interference patterns and video snow as well. Probably something to do with the warp drive that none of them knew the first thing about. So she had what she had on tape essentially was a bunch of slightly thin and discoloured people sitting around watching televisions that were showing network broadcasts. She also had pointed the camera out of the very tiny viewport near her seat and got a nice slightly streaky effect of stars. She knew it was real, but it would have taken a good 3-4 minutes to fake. In the end, she had decided to save her precious videotape for Rupert itself, and had simply sat back and watched the television with them. She'd even dozed off for a while. So, part of her sick feeling came from the sense that she had had all that time in an alien spacecraft of astounding technological design, and had spent most of it dozing in front of reruns of MASH and Cagney and Lacey. But what else was there to do? She had taken some of the photos. She had taken some photos as well, of course, all of which had subsequently turned out to be badly fogged when she got them back from the chemist. God, can you remember? If you're listening, old enough to remember sending photos off to get them developed, there's a number of people listening to this that have no idea what that's like. Another part of her sickly feeling probably came from the landing on Rupert. This, at least, had been dramatic and hair-raising. The ship had come sweeping in over a dark and sombre landscape, a terrain so desperately far removed from the heat and light of its parent sun that it seemed like a map of the psychological scars on the mind of an abandoned child. Lights blazed through the frozen darkness and guided the ship into the mouth of some kind of cave that seemed to bend itself open to accept the small craft. Unfortunately, because of the angle of their approach and the depth at which the small, thick viewport was set into the craft's skin, it hadn't been possible to get the video camera to point directly at any of it. She ran through that bit of the tape. The camera was pointing directly at the sun. This was normally very bad for a video camera, but when the sun is roughly a third of a billion miles away, it doesn't do any harm. In fact, it hardly makes any impression at all. You just get a small point of light right in the middle of the frame, which could be just about anything. It was just one star in a multitude. Tricia fast-forwarded. Now, the next bit had been quite promising. They had emerged out of the ship into a vast grey hangar-like structure. This was clearly alien technology on a dramatic scale. Huge grey buildings under the dark canopy of the Perspex bubble. These were the same buildings that she had been looking at the end of the tape. She'd taken more footage of them while leaving Rupert a few hours later, just as she was about to reboard the spacecraft for the journey home. What did they remind her of? Well, as much as anything else, they had reminded her of a film set from just about any low-budget sci-fi movie in the last 20 years. A lot larger, of course, but it all looked thoroughly tawdry and unconvincing on the video screen. Apart from the dreadful picture quality she'd been struggling with, the unexpected effects of gravity, which was appreciably lower than that of Earth, and she had found it very hard to keep the camera from bouncing around in an embarrassingly unprofessional way. It was therefore impossible to make out any detail. And now, here was the leader coming forward to greet her, smiling and sticking his hand out. That was all he was called. The leader. None of the Grebulons had names, largely because they couldn't think of any. Tricia discovered that some of them had thought of calling themselves after characters from television programmes they'd picked up from Earth, but hard as they'd tried to call each other Wayne and Bobby and Chuck, some remnant of something lurking deep in the cultural subconsciousness that they brought with them from the distant stars which were their homes, must have told them that this really wasn't right and would not do. The leader had looked pretty much like all the others, possibly a bit less thin. He said how much he enjoyed her shows on TV, that he was her greatest fan, how glad he was that she had been able to come along and visit them on Rupert, and how much everybody had been looking forward to her coming, how he hoped the flight had been comfortable, and so on and so on. There was no particular sense she could detect of being any kind of emissary from the stars or anything. Certainly, watching it now on videotape, he just looked like some guy in a costume and makeup standing in front of a set that wouldn't hold up too well if you leant against it. She sat, staring at the screen with her face cradled in her hands and shaking her head in slow bewilderment. This was awful. Not only was this bit awful, but she knew what was coming next. It was the bit where the leader asked if she was hungry after the flight, and would she perhaps like to come and have something to eat. They could discuss things over a little dinner. She could remember what she was thinking at this point. Alien food! How was she going to deal with it? Would she actually have to eat it? Would she have access to some sort of paper napkin she could spit stuff into? Wouldn't there be all sorts of differential immunity problems? It turned out to be hamburgers. Not only did it turn out to be hamburgers, but the hamburgers it turned out to be were very clearly and very obviously McDonald's hamburgers, which had just been reheated in a microwave. It wasn't just the look of them, it wasn't just the smell, it was the polystyrene clamshell packages they came in, which had McDonald's printed all over them. "Eat! Enjoy!" said the leader. "Nothing is too good for our honoured guest!" This was in his private apartment. Tricia had looked round it in bewilderment that had bordered on fear, but had nevertheless got it all on videotape. The apartment had a waterbed in it, and a MIDI hi-fi, and one of those tall, electrically illuminated glass things which sit on tabletops and appear to have large globules of sperm floating about in them. The walls were covered in velvet. The leader lounged against a brown corduroy beanbag and squirted breath freshener into his mouth. Tricia began to feel very scared, suddenly. She was further from Earth than any human being, to her knowledge, had ever been, and she was with an alien creature who was lounging against a brown corduroy beanbag and squirting breath freshener into his mouth. She didn't want to make any false moves. She didn't want to alarm him, but there were things she had to know. "How did you... where did you get... this?" she asked, gesturing around the room nervously. "The decor," asked the leader. "Do you like it? It is very sophisticated. We are a sophisticated people, we Grebulons. We buy sophisticated consumer durables, by mail order." Tricia had nodded tremendously slowly at this point. "Mail order," she had said. The leader chuckled. It was one of those dark chocolate, reassuring, silky chuckles. "Ah, I think you think they ship it here. No, ha, ha, ha. We have arranged a special box number in New Hampshire. We make regular pick-up visits. Ha, ha, ha." He lounged back in a relaxed fashion on his beanbag, reached for a reheated French fry, and nibbled the end off it, an amused smile playing across his lips. Tricia could feel her brain beginning to bubble very slightly. She kept the video camera going. How do you pay for these wonderful things? The leader chuckled again. Ha ha ha, American Express. Tricia nodded slowly again. She knew that they gave cards exclusively to just about anybody. "And these," she said, holding up the hamburger he had presented her with. "It is very easy," said the leader. "We stand in line." Again, Tricia realised with a cold, trickling feeling going down her spine. That explained an awful lot. She hit the fast-forward button again. There was nothing of any use here at all. It was all nightmarish madness. She could have faked something that would have looked more convincing. Another sick feeling began to creep over her as she watched this hopeless, awful tape, and she began, with slow horror, to realise that it must be the answer. She must be. She shook her head and tried to get a grip. An overnight flight going east. The sleeping pills she'd taken to get her through it. The vodka she'd had to get the sleeping pills going. What else? Well, there were 17 years of obsession that a glamorous man with two heads, one of which was disguised as a parrot in a cage, had tried to pick her up at a party but then had impatiently flown off to another planet in a flying saucer. There suddenly seemed to be all sorts of bothersome aspects to that idea that had never really occurred to her. Never occurred to her in 17 years. She stuffed her fist into her mouth. She must get help. Then there had been Eric Bartlett banging on about aliens, an alien spacecraft landing on her lawn. And before that, New York had been, well, very hot and very stressful. The high hopes and the bitter disappointment, the astrology stuff. She must have had a nervous breakdown. That was it. She was exhausted. And she had had a nervous breakdown and had started hallucinating sometime after she got home. She had dreamt the whole story. An alien race of people, dispossessed of their own lives and histories, stuck on a remote outpost of our solar system and filling their cultural vacuum with our cultural junk. Ha! It was just nature's way of telling her to get a check into an expensive medical establishment very quickly. She was very, very sick. She looked at how many large coffees she'd got through as well and realised how heavily she was breathing and how fast. Part of solving any problem, she told herself, was realising you had it in the first place. She started to bring her breathing under control. She had caught herself just in time. She had seen where she was. She was on the way back from whatever psychological precipice she had been on the brink of. She started to calm down. To calm down. To calm down. She sat back in the chair and closed her eyes. After a while, now that she was breathing normally again, she opened them again. So where had she got this tape from then? It was still running. All right, it was a fake. She had faked it herself. Yeah, that was it. It must have been her who had faked it because her voice was all over the soundtrack, asking questions. Every now and then the camera would swing down at the end of a shot and she would see her own feet in her own shoes. She had faked it and she had no recollection of faking it or any idea of why she had done it. Her breathing was getting hectic again as she watched the snowy, flickering screen. She must still be hallucinating. She shook her head, trying to make it go away. She had no memory of faking any of this very obviously fake stuff. On the other hand, she did seem to have memories that were very like the faked stuff. She continued to watch in a bewildered trance. The person she imagined to be called the leader was questioning her about astrology, and she was answering smoothly and calmly. Only she could detect the well-disguised rising panic in her own voice. The leader pushed a button, and a maroon velvet wall slid aside, revealing a large bank of flat TV monitors. Each of the monitors was showing a kaleidoscope of different images. A few seconds from a game show, a few seconds from a cop show, a few seconds from a supermarket warehouse security system, a few seconds from somebody's holiday movies, a few seconds of sex, a few seconds of news, a few seconds of comedy. It was clear that the leader was very proud of all this stuff, and he was waving his hands like a conductor while continuing at the same time to talk complete gibberish. Another wave of his hands, and all the screens cleared to form one giant computer screen, showing in diagrammatic form all the planets of the solar system and mapped out against a background of the stars in their constellations. The display was completely static. "We have great skills," the leader was saying. "Great skills in computation, in cosmological trigonometry, in three-dimensional navigational calculus. Great skills, great, great skills. Only we have lost them. It is too bad. We like to have skills, only they have gone. They are in space, somewhere, hurtling, with our names and the details of our homes and loved ones. Please," he said, gesturing her forward to sit at the computer's console, "be skillful for us." Obviously, what happened next was that Trisha quickly set the video camera up on its tripod to capture the whole scene. She then walked into a shot herself and sat down calmly in front of the giant computer display, spent a few moments familiarizing herself with the interface, and then started smoothly and competently to pretend that she hadn't the faintest idea what it was she was doing. It hadn't been that difficult, in fact. She was, after all, a mathematician and astrophysicist by training and a television presenter by experience. And what science she had forgotten over the years was more than capable of making up. She was more than capable of making up by bluffing. The computer she was working on was clear evidence that the Grebulons came from a far more advanced and sophisticated culture than their current vacuous state suggested, and with its aid she was able, within about half an hour, to cobble together a rough working model of the solar system. It wasn't particularly accurate or anything, but it looked good. The planets were whizzing around in reasonably good simulations of their orbits, and you could watch the movement of the whole piece of virtual cosmological clockwork from any point within the system, very roughly. You could watch from Earth, you could watch from Mars, etc. You could watch from the surface of the planet Rupert. Trisha had been quite impressed with herself, but also very impressed with the computer system she was working on. Using a computer workstation on Earth, the task would probably have taken a year or so of programming. When she was finished, the leader came up behind her and watched. He was very pleased and delighted with what she had achieved. "Good," he had said. "And now, please, I would like you to demonstrate how to use the system you have just designed to translate the information in this book for me." Quietly, he put a book down in front of her. It was You and Your Planets by Gail Andrews. Trisha stopped the tape again. She was definitely feeling very wobbly indeed. The feeling that she was hallucinating had now receded, but had not left anything any easier or clearer in her head. She pushed back her seat from the editing desk and wondered what to do. Years ago, she had left the field of astronomical research because she knew without any doubt whatsoever that she had met a being from another planet at a party. And she had also known, without any doubt whatsoever, that she would have made herself a laughingstock if she had ever said so. But how could she study cosmology? How could she study cosmology and not say anything about the single most important thing she knew about? She had done the only thing she could do. She left. She had now started working in television, and the same thing had happened again. She had videotape, actual videotape, of the most astounding story in the history of, well, anything. A forgotten outpost of an alien civilization marooned on the outermost planet of our own solar system. She had the story. She had been there. She had seen it. She had the videotape, for God's sake. And if she ever showed it to anybody, she would be a laughingstock. Slap of tea. How could she prove any of this? It wasn't even worth thinking about. The whole thing was a nightmare from virtually any angle she cared to look at it. Her head was beginning to throb. She had... cosmology, Mum, sorry. How could she prove any of this? It wasn't even worth thinking about. The whole thing was a nightmare from virtually any angle she cared to look at. Her head was beginning to throb. She had some aspirin in her bag. She went out of the little editing suite to the water dispenser down the corridor. She took the aspirin and drank several cups of water. The place seemed to be very quiet. Usually there were more people bustling about the place, or at least some people bustling about the place. She popped her head round the door of the editing suite next to hers. But there was no one there. She had gone rather overboard keeping people out of her own suite. "Do not disturb," the notice read. "Do not even think of entering. I don't care what it is. Go away. I'm busy." When she went back, she noticed that the message light on her phone extension was winking and wondered how long it had been doing so. "Hello," she said to the receptionist. "Oh, Miss Macmillan, I'm so glad you called. Everybody's been trying to reach you. Your TV company, they're desperate to get hold of you. Can you call them?" "Why didn't you put them through?" said Tricia. "You said I wasn't to put anyone through for anything. You said I was to deny you that you were even here. I didn't know what to do. I came up to give you a message, but..." "Okay," said Tricia, cursing herself. She phoned her office. "Tricia, where the hemorrhaging fuck are you? At the editing, they said..." "I know. What's up?" "What's up? Only a bloody alien spaceship." "What? Where?" "Regent's Park. Big silver job. Some girl with a bird. She speaks English and throws rocks at people and wants someone to repair her watch. Just get there." Tricia stared at it. It wasn't a Grebulon ship. Not that she was suddenly an expert on extraterrestrial craft, but this was a sleek and beautiful silver and white thing about the size of a large ocean-going yacht, which is what it most resembled. Next to this, the structures of the huge, half-dismantled Grebulon ship looked like gun turrets on a battleship. Gun turrets? That's what those blank grey buildings had looked like. And what was odd about them was that by the time she passed them again on her way to reboarding the small Grebulon craft, they had moved. These things flitted briefly through her head as she ran from the taxi to meet her camera crew. "Where's the girl?" she shouted above the noise of helicopters and police sirens. "There!" shouted the producer, while the sound engineer hurried to clip a radio mic to her. "She says her mother and father came from here in some parallel dimension or something like that, and she's got her father's watch and... I don't know. What can I tell you? Busk it. Ask her what it feels like to be from outer space." "Thanks a lot, Ted," muttered Tricia, checked that her mic was securely clipped, gave the engineer some level, took a deep breath, tossed her hair back and switched into her role of professional reporter, on home ground, ready for anything. At least, nearly anything. She turned to look for the girl. That must be her, with the wild hair and wild eyes. The girl turned towards her and stared. "Mother!" she screamed, and started to hurl rocks at Tricia. I'm just going to check something quickly, see how far we are through this, because... I think we're probably going to get two more episodes. Hold on. This one, the next one. Maybe not. Because it's, what is it? It is 21:37. I don't want to be talking forever, and I don't want to make the last episode too short. It's kind of difficult to know. Let's do one more chapter and then call it a day. Let me just have a quick look. Hold on. No, let's crack on. Let's crack on, I think. Yeah, let's crack on. This might be it. This might be the last one. Exciting. Daylight exploded around them. Hot, heavy sun. A desert plain stretched out ahead in a haze of heat. They thundered out into it. "Jump!" shouted Ford Prefect. "What?" shouted Arthur Dent, holding on for dear life. There was no reply. "What did you say?" shouted Arthur again, and then realised that Ford Prefect was no longer there. He looked around in panic and started to slip. Realising he couldn't hold on any longer, he pushed himself sideways as hard as he could and rolled into a ball as he hit the ground, rolling, rolling, rolling away from the pounding hooves. What a day, he thought, as he started furiously coughing up dust out of his lungs. He hadn't had a day as bad as this since the earth had been blown up. He staggered up to his knees, and then up to his feet, and started to run away. He didn't know from what, or what to, but running away seems to be a prudent move. He ran straight into Ford Prefect, who was standing there surveying the scene. "Look," said Ford, "that is precisely what we need." Arthur coughed up some more dust and wiped some other dust out of his hair and eyes and turned panting to look at what Ford was looking at. He didn't look much like the domain of a king, or the king, or any kind of king. It looked quite inviting, though. First, the context. This was a desert world. The dusty earth was packed hard and had neatly bruised every last bit of Arthur that hadn't already been bruised by the festivities of the previous night. Some way ahead of them were great cliffs that looked like sandstone eroded by the wind and what little rain presumably fell in those parts into wild and fantastic shapes, which matched the fantastic shapes of the giant cacti that sprouted here and there from the arid orange landscape. For a moment, Arthur dared to hope they had unexpectedly arrived in Arizona, or New Mexico, or maybe South Dakota, but there was plenty of evidence that this was not the case. The perfectly normal beasts were, for a start, still thundering and still pounding. They swept up in their tens of thousands from the far horizon, disappeared completely for about half a mile, and then swept off thundering and pounding into the distant horizon opposite. Then there were the spaceships, parked in front of the bar and grill. Ah, the domain of the king, bar and grill. Bit of an anticlimax, thought Arthur to himself. In fact, only one of the spaceships was parked in front of the domain of the bar, domain of the king, bar and grill. The other three were in a parking lot by the side of the bar and grill. It was the one in front that caught the eye, though. Wonderful looking thing. Wild fins all over it. Far, far too much chrome all over the fins, and most of the actual bodywork painted in a shocking pink. It crouched there, like an immense brooding insect, and looked as if it was at any moment about to jump on something about half a mile away. The domain of the King Bar and Grill was slap-bang in the middle of where the perfectly normal beasts would be charging if they didn't take a minor trans-dimensional diversion on the way. It stood on its own, undisturbed. An ordinary bar and grill. A truck stop diner. Somewhere in the middle of nowhere. Quiet. The domain of the king. "Gonna buy that spaceship," said Ford quietly.
"Buy it?" said Arthur. "That's not like you. I thought you usually pinched them."
"Sometimes," said Ford, "you have to show a little respect."
"Probably have to show a little cash as well," said Arthur. "How the hell as much is that thing worth?"
With a tiny movement, Ford brought his Dino Charge credit card up out of his pocket. Arthur noticed that the hand holding it was trembling very slightly. "I'll teach them to make me the restaurant critic," breathed Ford.
"What do you mean?" asked Arthur tremulously.
"I'll show you," said Ford with a nasty glint in his eye. "Let's go and run up a few expenses, shall we?"
"Couple of beers," said Ford. "Oh, and I don't know, a couple of bacon rolls, whatever you've got. Oh, and that pink thing outside."
He flipped his card on top of the bar and looked around casually. There was a kind of silence. There hadn't been a lot of noise before, but there was definitely a kind of silence now. Even the distant thunder of the perfectly normal beasts, carefully avoiding the domain of the king, seemed suddenly a little muted.
"Just rode into town," said Ford, as if nothing was odd about that or anything else.
He was leaning at the bar at an extravagantly relaxed angle. There were about three other customers in the place, sitting at tables nursing beers. About three. Some people would say there were exactly three, but it wasn't that kind of a place. Not the kind of place that you felt like being that specific in. There was some big guy setting up some stuff on a little stage as well. Old drum kit, a couple of guitars, country and western kind of stuff. The barman was not moving very swiftly to get in Ford's order. In fact, he wasn't moving at all.
"Not sure the pink thing's for sale," he said at last, in the kind of accent that went on for a long time.
"Sure it is," said Ford.
"How much do you want?"
"Well, think of a number. I'll double it."
"'Tain't mine to sale," said the barman.
"So whose?" The barman nodded at the big guy setting up on stage. Big fat guy, moving slow, balding. Ford nodded. He grinned.
"Okay," he said. "Get the beers, get the rolls, and keep the tab open."
Arthur sat at the bar and rested. He was used to not knowing what the hell was going on. He felt comfortable with it. The beer was pretty good and it made him a little sleepy, which he didn't mind one bit. The bacon rolls were not bacon rolls. They were perfectly normal beast rolls. He exchanged a few professional roll-making remarks with the barman and just let Ford get on with whatever Ford wanted to do.
"Okay," said Ford, returning to his stool. "It's cool. We got the pink thing."
The barman was very surprised.
"He's selling it to you?"
"He's giving it to us for free," said Ford, taking a gnaw at his roll.
"Hey, no, no, no. Keep the tab open, though. We have some items to add to it."
"Good roll." He took a deep pull of beer.
"Ooh, good beer," he added.
"Good ship, too," he said, eyeing the big pink and chrome insect-like thing, bits of which could be seen through the windows of the bar.
"Good everything, pretty much."
"You know," he said, sitting back reflectively, It's at times like this that you kind of wonder if it's worth worrying about the fabric of space-time and the causal integrity of the multidimensional probability matrix and the potential collapse of all waveforms in the whole sort of general mishmash and all that sort of stuff that's been bugging me. Maybe I feel that what the big guy says is right. Just let it all go. What does it matter? Let it go. Which big guy? Said Arthur. Ford just nodded towards the stage. The big guy was saying, 1, 2, 1, 2, into the mic a few times. A couple other guys were on the stage now. Drums, guitar. The barman, who had been silent for a moment or two, said, You say he's letting you have his ship? Yeah, said Ford. Let it all go, is what he said. Take the ship. Take it with my blessing. Be good to her. I will be good to her. He took a pull at his beer again. Like I was saying, he went on, it's at times like this that you kind of think, let it all go. But then you think of guys like Infinidim Enterprises, and you think, they are not going to get away with it. They are going to suffer. It is my sacred and holy duty to see those guys suffer. Here, let me put something on the tab for the singer. I asked for a special request and we agreed. It's to go on the tab, okay? Okay, said the barman cautiously, and then he shrugged. Okay, however you want to do it. How much? Ford named a figure. The barman fell over amongst the bottles and glasses. Ford vaulted quickly over the bar to check that he was all right and to help him back up onto his feet. He cut his finger and his elbow a bit and was feeling a little woozy but was otherwise fine. The big guy started to sing. The barman hobbled off with Ford's credit card to get authorization. Is there stuff going on here that I don't know about? Said Arthur to Ford. Isn't there usually? Said Ford. No need to be like that, said Arthur. He began to wake up. Shouldn't we be going? He said suddenly. Will that ship get us to Earth? Sure will, said Ford. That's where Random will be going, said Arthur with a start. We can follow her, but... Ford let Arthur get on with thinking about things for himself. Ford let Arthur get on with thinking things out for himself while he got out his old edition of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But where are we on the probability axis thing? Said Arthur. Will the Earth be there or not? I spent so much time looking for it. All I found was planets that were a bit like it or not at all like it, that it was clearly the right place because of all the continents. The worst version was called Now What, where I got bitten by some wretched little animal. That's how they communicated, you know, by biting each other. Bloody painful. Then half the time, of course, the Earth isn't even there because it's been blown up by the bloody Vogons. How much sense am I making? Ford didn't comment. He was listening to something. He passed the guide over to Arthur and pointed at the screen. The active entry read, Earth, mostly harmless. You mean it's there? Said Arthur excitedly. The Earth is there? That's where Random will be going. The bird was showing her the Earth in a rainstorm. Ford motioned Arthur to shout a little less loudly. He was listening. Arthur was growing impatient. He'd heard bar singers singing Love Me Tender before. He was a bit surprised to hear it here, right in the middle of wherever this hell was, certainly not Earth, but then things tended not to surprise him these days as much as they used to do formerly. The singer was actually quite good, as bar singers went, if you like that sort of thing, but Arthur was getting fretful. He glanced at his watch. This only served to remind him that he didn't have his watch anymore. Random had it, or at least the remains of it. "Don't you think we should be going?" he said insistently. "Shh," said Ford. "I paid to hear this song." He seemed to have tears in his eyes, which Arthur found a bit disturbing. He'd never seen Ford moved by anything other than very, very strong drink. Probably the dust. He waited, tapping his fingers irritably out of time with the music.
The song ended. The singer went on to do Heartbreak Hotel. "Anyway," Ford whispered, "I've got to review the restaurant."
"What?"
"I have to write a review." "Write a review of this place?"
"Filing the review validates the expenses claim. I've fixed it so that that happens automatically, completely and untraceably. This bill is going to need some validation," he added quietly, staring into his beer with a nasty smirk.
"For a couple of beers and a roll?"
"And a tip for the singer."
"Why, how much did you tip him?"
Ford named a figure again.
I don't know how much that is," said Arthur. "What's it worth in pounds sterling? What would it buy you?"
"It would probably buy you roughly..." Ford screwed up his eyes as he did some calculations in his head.
"Switzerland," he said at last. He picked up his hitchhiker's guide and started to type.
Arthur nodded intelligently. There were times when he wished he understood what on earth Ford was talking about, and other times, like now, when he felt it was probably safer not even to try. He looked over Ford's shoulder.
"This isn't going to take long, is it?" he said.
"Nah," said Ford. "Piece of piss. Just mentioned that the rolls were quite good, the beer was good and cold, local wildlife nicely eccentric, the bar singer the best in the known universe, and that's about it. Doesn't need much, just a validation." He touched an area on the screen marked Enter, and the message vanished into the sub-ether.
"You thought the singer was pretty good, then?"
"Yeah," said Ford. The barman was returning with a piece of paper which seemed to be trembling in his hand. He pushed it over to Ford with a kind of nervous, reverential twitch.
"Funny thing," said the barman. "The system rejected it the first couple of times. Can't say it surprised me." Beads of sweat were standing on his brow. "Then suddenly it's, 'Oh yeah, that's okay.' And the system, validates it. Just like that. You want to sign it?"
Ford scanned the form quickly. He sucked his teeth.
"This is going to hurt Infinidim a lot," he said, with an appearance of concern.
"Oh well," he added softly, "screw 'em."
He signed with a flourish and handed it back to the barman.
"More money," he said, "than the Colonel made for him in an entire career of doing crap movies and casino gigs, just for doing what he does best, standing up and singing in a bar. And he negotiated it himself. I think this is a good moment for him. Tell him I said thanks and buy him a drink." He tossed a few coins on the bar. The barman pushed them away.
"I don't think that's strictly necessary," he said slightly hoarsely.
"'Tis to me," said Ford.
"Okay, we are out of here."
They stood in the heat and the dust and looked at the big pink and chrome thing with amazement and admiration. Or at least Ford looked at it with amazement and admiration. Arthur just looked at it.
"You don't think it's a bit overdone, do you?"
He said it again, and when they climbed inside it. The seats and quite a lot of the controls were covered in fine fur, skin or suede. There was a big gold monogram on the main control panel, which just read EP.
"You know," said Ford as he fired up the ship's engines, "I asked him if it was true that he had been abducted by aliens. You know what he said?"
"Who?" said Arthur.
"The king."
"Which king?"
"Oh, we've had this conversation, haven't we?"
"Never mind," said Ford.
"For what it's worth, he said no. He went of his own accord."
"I'm still not sure at all who we're talking about," said Arthur.
Ford shook his head. "Look," he said, "there are some tapes over in the compartment to your left. Why don't you choose some music and put it on?" "Okay," said Arthur and flipped through the cartons. "Do you like Elvis Presley?" he said. "Yeah, I do, as a matter of fact," said Ford. "Now, I hope this machine can leap like it looks like it can." He engaged the main drive. "Yee-ha!" shouted Ford as they shot upwards at face-tearing speed. It could. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is where we will leave it for this evening. I think that's a good spot. We are moving swiftly to the conclusion. I think we might actually get that finished next week. I might extend next week's episode a little. I'll do a test read during the week to see how long it'll take. But I'm not sure we're going to get two full episodes out of what's left of the book. So we'll probably wrap up the book in the 30 or the original 5-book trilogy within this. And then what I'll ask you to do is perhaps give some thought as to, now that we're getting close to the end of the Douglas Adams penned material, whether we should go with the Owen Colfer stuff, the extra 6th book that was penned, or if we should draw a line under the Hitchhiker's Guide and perhaps move on to something else, and give some thought and perhaps post on the Facebook page which stuff you think we should touch on. I've had a few people mention some stuff, but give me your ideas, give me your thoughts, and we'll take it on from there. But thank you very much, as always, everybody, for your company this evening. This is, as I say, more or less the anniversary of the first version, the first episode that I did way, 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 way back when. 150,000 listeners around the world later, here we all are, and here you are. So thank you very much for your support. If you haven't already done so, please go over to patreon.com/thebeardedwit and become a patron and support this podcast and all the other stuff that I'm doing. I would really appreciate that. But for now, for this evening, take care, look after yourselves, and I will see you same time, same place next week. All right, guys. Take care. Night all.